The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. My name is Jason Freeman. I'm a producer and editor here in the Free Library's author events office, and I'm honored to be here to introduce tonight's author, Woody Holton, the McCausland Professor of History at the University of South Carolina. Woody Holton teaches early U.S. history, specializing in economics, African-American history, indigenous history, and women's history. His many books include the Bancroft Prize-winning biography, Abigail Adams, Forced Founders, Indians, Debtors, Slaves, and the Making of the American Revolution in Virginia, winner of the Merle Curti Award from the Organization of American Historians, and Unruly Americans and the Origins of the Constitution, a National Book Award finalist. He is also the recipient of fellowships from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Guggenheim Foundation. He joins us tonight with Liberty is Sweet, The Hidden History of the American Revolution. In it, he employs more than 1,000 primary accounts to offer a wide-ranging reassessment of marginalized people's contributions to U.S. independence and their conflicts with the values, decisions, and agendas of the Founding Fathers. Nicole Hannah-Jones, creator of the 1619 Project, and who will appear on our stage on November 17th, get your tickets now, writes the following about Liberty is Sweet. This book decenters the almost exclusively white revolutionary narratives that we've all been taught and instead makes visible the influence and agency of Black and Indigenous people, as well as white women, who together played such a critical, if erased, role in creating this multiracial nation. This book unsettles the reader in the best possible way and shows once again how the simplistic histories of our founding fail to explain the divided country in which we all live. Tonight's author will be in conversation with Adam McNeil. He is a PhD candidate in the Department of History at Rutgers University, where he writes about Black women from the Chesapeake Bay during the Revolutionary and founding eras. Adam's research has been supported by fellowships from the University of Michigan's Clements Library, which I believe he is in Michigan now, the David Center for the American Revolution at the American Philosophical Society, and the Omohundro Institute of Early American History and Culture. In addition to academic writing, Adam regularly contributes to academic blogs, Black Perspectives, and the Junto, and regularly interviews scholars on the New Books in African American Studies podcast, where he has interviewed nearly 100 scholars about their works in African American Studies and African American History. Woody, Adam, thank you both so much for being here, and the screen is all yours.
Thanks, Jason.
Thank you. Thank you, Jason. Woody, my friend, we are here today. Good to see you.
Nice to see you as well.
Yeah, so with you know, hearts really to your family, you know, your father, as we learned today, former governor of Virginia, Linwood Holton, your father unfortunately passed away earlier today. And so on the live screen, just wanted to give you and your family my deepest condolences, love, and prayers. And in commemoration of him, let's please do a short moment of silence in commemoration of the amazing life of your father and all that he meant to not only you and your family, but also to the nation too. So we'll just take that moment of silence right now.
Thanks, Adam.
So, like I said, man, we are here. This is not March of 2017 when I first emailed you from my cousin's Dalzell, South Carolina, right outside of Columbia, South Carolina, for those who don't know, requesting to, you know, see if I could work with you. So almost, 5 years later, we're on the main stage here at the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Rutgers won that battle, but I'm going to win the war because I want to stick with you as long as I'm doing this. I'm really glad to be talking to you, Adam.
Well, hey, the good part about this whole lifelong PhD thing is, well, not lifelong in how long it takes you to get done.
Right.
And how the work that we do is constant, right? Lifelong. You know, working with you these last couple of years, last pretty much 5 years, it's been a great journey, and I'm glad that it brought us here to the Free Library of Philadelphia to talk about a book that I've been hearing a lot about in bits and pieces, really since we met, you know, like I said, around 5 years ago. And so the full title of your new book, which, hold on, let's also say congratulations.
Publishing
a book or getting a book published, that's hard. Like,
it is.
It's a hard thing. So the full title of your new book is Liberty is Sweet, The Hidden History of the American Revolution. That you have right there. It is, oh my gosh, cannot wait to get mine. I'm looking forward to it. I've been reading from a different copy. So looking forward to having it in my hand. So Woody, your book has in its title or its subtitle Hidden, right? And so I'm always interested to know the process for a historian, a writer, to get to that, you know, the hidden aspect, right? So to start tonight's festivities off, when did you get the first inkling to write a new history of the American Revolution? When did that come about, right? And also, when did the members of this hidden community here, when did they come to you in your kind of thoughts about and ruminations about the American Revolution? Because like I said, hidden is a very interesting term to use. So I'm interested to know more about the backstory for how you got here today.
Okay, I appreciate that two-part question. And let me take the second half of it first, which is, when did it occur to me that maybe there were some hidden participants in the American Revolution? You know, that is people who don't appear on the back of the $2 bill, which is the presentation of the Declaration of Independence. All guys looked a little bit like me, old white guys. Most of them look quite a bit wealthier than me since I'm a school teacher, but they kind of look the same, and they are the people who show up in many histories of the American Revolution, especially those famous founding fathers' biographies and a lot of the work that's still being done by scholars even. But I went to Duke for grad school and was really honored to be able to study from people like John Hope Franklin and Peter Wood and Ray Gavins, who were doing Bill Chafe social history, the ordinary lives, the average the daily lives of ordinary people. And then this goes to start to answer. So I learned that there was a lot more to North America than that. So for instance, we always talk about the 13 colonies. There were actually 26 British colonies in America in 1776. Most of the others were in the Caribbean, places like Jamaica and Barbados. Certainly that by population, that's where the bulk of the other 13 colonies were. And one in five people here in the 13 colonies that did rebel were Black and enslaved. About 5/6 of the continent was occupied not by European Americans and the people whom they had enslaved, but by Native Americans in 1776. And I say, of course, but we shouldn't say, of course, in all of these groups, 50% of the people are women. So these are all people that don't appear on the back of the $2 bill. And historians like Gary Nash, who's a real product of Philadelphia, wrote some of his best work about Philadelphia, including a great book about the role of abolitionists in turning the Liberty Bell into the Liberty Bell, had written the social history of the rest of us. But what I wanted to do, and after I finished my Abigail Adams biography, it seemed like a good time to do it, because I've been teaching the revolution my whole career. It's pretty much all I teach. I teach the U.S. History Survey up to 1865, but the specialized courses, I really teach the revolution. And I said, what I want to do is put the social history in with the traditional narrative of the Battle of Bunker Hill and the surrender at Saratoga and the victory at Yorktown and so forth, and see what it looks like when we don't take African-Americans and Native Americans and women and put them in a chapter at the back of the book, but intertwine them all the way through the narrative. So actually, you're talking about some of those fellowships I got to work on. This one out at the Huntington Library in California, I remember my title back then was An Integrated History of the American Revolution. People talk me out of that because integrated today tells people computers, and no one wants to read my book about computers. So I dropped integrated from the title, but that's really what I'm talking about. And there are some wonderful books about the revolution. For instance, Gary Nash's and my friend Alan Taylor wrote a wonderful book called American Revolutions with the emphasis on the S. And I think I have new things to say about a lot of these events, but I think the more important thing I try to contribute is to have a single narrative. So there's not a chapter on African-Americans and a chapter on women and a chapter on various other groups. Everybody's part of the same story. And I'll just give you a couple examples. My second one will be from Philadelphia. The first one from my home state of Virginia, and a battle that not many people have heard about, but Lafayette on the American side heard that his opponent Cornwallis on the British side, he knew that Cornwallis was near Jamestown. And while Lafayette was thinking, should I attack him? Should I not? And an African-American man appeared in Lafayette's camp and said, oh, you should definitely attack Cornwallis because he's moved half of his army across the James River and he has had a numerical advantage over you, Lafayette, but now he doesn't. He's only left half of his army here. You can swoop in and wipe out that little part of the army that's still left. And so Lafayette starts to think, that's what I'm going to do. But then another African-American man came and said, don't believe that other guy. The reality is this is a trick. Most of the British army, yeah, he sent a few people over there to the other side of the river, but that's just a trick. Yeah. Most of the British army is still right there outside Jamestown, ready to ambush you if you attack. And so Lafayette's decision about the battle, we call the Battle of Green Spring in July of 1781, was which African-American man do I believe? He decided to believe the first one who said, you got a great opportunity here, and he went right into an ambush. It's just one example, but I am able to do this throughout the book without forcing things, because if you're open to their presence, African-Americans, Native Americans, women, and poor whites, who we haven't talked about, are part of that story as well. Can I tell my Philadelphia story that shows the value of integrating things? So there's a famous description of the United States that was used a lot at the time, and you see it today. For instance, I have, as you know, a friend slash enemy named Gordon Wood, who's the real champion of American. He's the best known historian of the American Revolution. He won the National Humanities Medal and so forth. He wrote a book called Empire of Liberty, Empire of Liberty, taking that term for the United States from Thomas Jefferson. Two things we need to know about the context that I'm afraid are not covered in Gordon's book. The first is that when Jefferson proclaimed the United States an empire of liberty, he was doing so in December 1780 in a letter to George Rogers Clark saying, you got to go capture Detroit. We all know that New York and Philadelphia and Boston were crucial to the American Revolution, but so was Detroit, not as a town so much as a fort, a British fort surrounded by several towns of Native nations. And those Native nations were really winning the war in the West in 1780. And so there are all these plans to go attack Detroit. Jefferson was sending George Rogers Clark on one of those expeditions to starve the Native American enemies of the United States of their arms and ammunition coming from the British, which was Detroit. So he said, go destroy Detroit, then we can conquer the Indians and have an empire of liberty. So that's where that expression comes from a letter about conquering Native Americans. That's what I thought until I was researching this book. And then I learned, yes, that's what he was referring to, Jefferson was referring to in that letter of December 1780, but he got that phrase from Philadelphia because Esther Reed was a woman living in Philadelphia. Her husband was the highest official in the in the government of Pennsylvania in 1780. And 1780 was a real low point of the war for white colonists rebelling against the British. They lost Charleston, South Carolina, not far from where I live, and they'd had mutinies in their army. Their paper money was basically worthless. They were depressed. And Esther Reed had an idea of trying to cheer up the soldiers by organizing the free women of Philadelphia to go door to door, knocking on doors and raise money and give it to the soldiers. And she knew that would be controversial. You know, women are, especially of her class, the upper class, supposed to stay around the house and not be out on the street knocking on doors. And so she wrote a little pamphlet justifying what she was doing. And she pointed to the example of all these women who in history who had moved mountains. For instance, she said, Elizabeth I, the Queen of England during Shakespeare's day, and Catherine the Great, her contemporary in Russia, that is Elizabeth Esther Reed's contemporary in Russia, they had expanded the empire of liberty. And you could do all these searches electronically now, Adam, as you know better than anybody. And and Esther Reed, I discovered that no one had used that phrase, empire of liberty, other than to describe heaven, but no one had used it for worldly concerns until Esther Reed. And guess who she sent a copy of her pamphlet to? Martha Jefferson, the wife of Thomas Jefferson, who shared it with Governor Jefferson. I can't quite 100% prove it as in a court case, but I'm pretty darn sure that Thomas Jefferson stole one of his most famous phrases, after all men are created equal. He got it from Esther Reed, this Philadelphia woman who was organizing this very successful fundraising effort on behalf of the Continental soldiers.
It's really interesting that you you talked about that particular battle at first, your first vignette of sorts from July of 1781, because I literally was in the, I was actually in the papers, I forget, it was someone's letter book. It's in my iPad now, but I was literally looking at that precise document talking about that particular day, the particular battle. And so it's very ironic that that's one of the pieces of one of the vignettes that you bring up. And so in your story, you, like I said, you know, you talk about the hidden influences on the American Revolution and the jostling effectively back and forth. So one of the things I'm actually very interested about, because, and I'm actually going to go a little bit out of order of what I had thought about. But what you just talked about made me think about the importance of politics, right? Politics from below, that in effect, the hidden influences on the American Revolution and within it were definitely a part of this rumbling from below here. So can you actually talk about the politics of the enslaved here a little bit more, about the factors in the war? Because when I, you know, I was born in 1992. And so when I think about, right, what I learned as a kid about the quote unquote culture wars that were, you know, that were occurring like a little bit before I was born, but definitely around the time, they were definitely still around by the time 92 came. And I actually wondered what would be the one for the generation that I'm in. And so I think you ask and you shall be heard. You ask, you shall receive, Mr. McNeil. And so we are here. So can you talk a bit more about how Liberty is Sweet discusses the politics of the enslaved and in their actual decision-making? Because unlike the Civil War, where the side that you would go on is fairly important and pretty easy to see.
Yes.
The American Revolution was a little different. So can you talk a little bit more about the politics of the enslaved in your story?
Yeah, well, to speak to the last thing you said first, it is certainly true that enslaved people fought on both sides in the Revolutionary War. They fought for the British, they fought for the rebel colonists, so they called themselves the Americans. And, you know, there was a historian in 1961, and you can tell that it was from 61 by his title, Benjamin Quarles, who taught in HBCU, Morgan State. And Quarles' book was called The Negro in the American Revolution. And he was the first to, others had written about African Americans on the Patriot side, but he was the first to also say many fought on the British side. Not the very first, but the first to do a book length study of them. And his point was they weren't loyal to the British and they weren't loyal to the Americans. African Americans were loyal to the principle of freedom. And that meant in the North, the majority of them fought on the American side, but of course the vast majority, in fact, more than 90% of African Americans at the time of the Revolution were in the South. And so here's what happened. Let me start at the end, where I think is the kind of the end of this story, the political story, and that is the capstone grievance in the Declaration of Independence. And in those days, they saved the best for last. So they had 26 grievances against the king. But the last and the real closing argument in favor of independence was, quote, "He has instigated domestic insurrections amongst us." Now, that's so euphemistic that a lot of people just read right through it, having no idea what it means or thinking maybe it has a general meaning. Actually, it has a very specific meaning. What the Congress meeting in Philadelphia was angry about and was expressing in those seven words was that British officers, formally Lord Dunmore, the last royal governor of Virginia, but informally other governors and Royal Navy captains, they had formed what I would call an alliance with African Americans. Now, this doesn't mean that the British had suddenly turned against slavery. Governor Dunmore had slaves of his own and he wasn't giving them up. But he said, if you are owned by patriots, if you're able and willing to bear arms, which implies men, although the majority of those who joined him were women and children, and most importantly, if you can get to me, I'm not coming to you, you got to get to me. If you meet those three conditions as an enslaved Virginian, I will free you in return for you fighting for your king. And by the end of the war, thousands of African Americans had done that. But even before the Declaration of Independence, something like 800, as Quarles' estimate, had done that. And we want to talk about what happened to them. We don't want to forget about them. But for a second, let me answer your political question. How do they influence whites in the American Revolution? And I'll say tremendously, because you have all these African Americans fighting for the British, and imagine how white Americans felt about that. The governor is supposed to be protecting them from slave revolt, and here he is, in essence, leading a slave revolt. And so one thing I'm doing on Twitter right now, and I appreciate all the likes and retweets I've gotten from you, but I've been putting up 76 quotes from white Americans expressing their anger at this informal alliance between the British and the Blacks. Like the one that went up today from Archibald Cary in Virginia talks about the British aiming a dagger at our throats through the hands of our slaves. And the reason I feel like the need to put up these 76 quotes, because, well, that's gonna conclude on November 16th with the publication of Nicole Hannah Jones's book. And I'm gonna be back here right at this website on the other side of the camera watching Nicole Hannah Jones introducing her book. I think Jason said she'll be here on the 17th at the Free Library, the day after that book comes out. So I've been leading into the publication of the 1619 Project book with all of this evidence, because one of the big claims made against the 1619 Project was, oh no, African-Americans had nothing to do with the American Revolution. They may have been affected by it, but the critics say they didn't affect it. But I would say that in the South, one of the things that really infuriated white Southerners and turned them into, from what merely being protesters to getting them to jump off the cliff into independence, was their anger at the British for this alliance that they had apparently formed with the slaves. And the reason I stuck that apparently in there is that, you know, not everybody watching knows, the British didn't initiate this alliance with enslaved people. Enslaved people had been coming to them for a year. before the British finally agreed to this alliance. So the Declaration of Independence says, the king, he has excited domestic insurrection amongst us. It's really African Americans who had incited the British against the white colonists. And so if you ignore Black people, you don't understand why the American Revolution happened. It would be like ignoring the Battle of Lexington and Concord, or that beautiful pamphlet published in Philadelphia, Thomas Paine's Common Sense. You can't start your history of the American Revolution in 1776.
And it's interesting that you talk about that, because when we talk about the politics of the enslaved, you've shown this actually on Twitter as well. There's a gentleman by the name of Lemuel Haynes that is an important figure that maybe the audience doesn't necessarily know as much about, because, you know, we have a broad audience in our 53 attendees here. So can you also talk about, right, the importance of folks like Lemuel Haynes, rather, to your story, especially as we move closer to that 250th anniversary that is going to take up all of our attention, if it hasn't already started to do so?
Yes, I'm going to answer your question, but first I can't help commenting, because I didn't see the list of number of attendees, 53. What I do see is that 8 people have questions, and that's how I know I'm in Philadelphia. When you've got 53 people and already this early on, 8 have questions, and some of those are probably comments. I'm really looking forward to you folks' questions. If I don't get to them all, send them to me on Twitter. And so I'll plug my Twitter account. It's just Woody Holton USC, since I teach at the University of South Carolina, the real USC, as we say on the East Coast. But to answer your question, one of the things I'm doing in that on Twitter is what I just said, documenting the African American role in bringing about the Declaration of Independence. And of course, I'm not saying they're the only ones who contributed to it, but I'm saying they're a major factor through that alliance they initiated with the British. They African Americans helped bring about the Declaration of Independence. But then let's look at what they had wrought. The actual decision to declare independence was made 2 days earlier on July 2nd by the Continental Congress in Philadelphia. And I was just talking to the great South Carolina historian today, Walter Edgar, and he correctly, and in my opinion, identified the decision to declare independence as a secession act. Because now, and I don't mean to get into the secession associations that we're going to have in the Civil War. But what was happening, according to the Continental Congress, was 13 parts of the British Empire are seceding from the rest of the British Empire. So it's a Declaration of Independence. It's a breakup letter. And that's all it was. And in fact, it's breaking up with Britain in order to form a new alliance with France. And most historians agree that's what finally pushed Congress, after a lot of hemming and hawing, to go ahead and break away from, make it an official break with Britain. They'd already been at war with Britain for more than a year. Why did they go ahead and make it official? Because they wanted to get an alliance with France. And in fact, several members of the Congress were saying, if we can declare independence quick enough, we can have a French Navy in American waters by August of 1776. So the Declaration of Independence originally was intended as an overture to the French to get them to send their army and navy to help the colonists defeat the British. And in that goal, Adam, it failed. It failed because it was not in the summer of 1776 that a French fleet arrived bringing a French army. That didn't happen until 1778. And so in its initial purpose, the Declaration of Independence was a failure. But it said, as you know, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. And Lemuel Haynes, who you just mentioned, and I have sort of a sub-series of this Twitter thread I'm doing called the hashtag Lemuel Haynes Project, that a student of mine is doing all the work on and doing a terrific job. And here's why we're doing that. Because Lemuel Haynes in 1776, when he got his hands on the Declaration of Independence, was a free Black soldier serving in the Continental Army. And he had already written a pamphlet called Liberty Further Extended that was against slavery. And he took what's now the iconic sentence in the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident. All men are created equal, endowed by the Creator with certain inalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. He took that and made it the epigraph. That is the opening quote in his pamphlet. And that made Lemuel Haynes the first person ever to quote what has become the iconic phrase in the Declaration of Independence. And in fact, he began the process of making it the iconic phrase in the Declaration of Independence, because everybody had quoted it. Most of the people who quoted it at the time, the whites who quoted it, they were focused on the secession clauses, but he was focused on the freedom clause and the equality clause. And here's what Eric Slaughter, who's a literary scholar up at the University of Chicago, discovered: that the majority, and in fact, my student found it to be 70% of the people who quoted all men are created equal during the rest of the 18th century, that is from 1776 to 1799, the majority of the people who quoted that phrase were abolitionists, both Black abolitionists like Lemuel Haynes and Benjamin Banneker, who quoted it back to Thomas Jefferson in a famous exchange of letters in 1791, and white abolitionists like those famous and so admirable Philadelphia Quakers, who were the first white people to really come out against slavery on a grand scale. Here's what they did. They shifted the focus of the Declaration from secession document to Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is what, that's how it succeeded as a freedom document. But it wouldn't have succeeded if it hadn't been for Lemuel Haynes and these other abolitionists and later women's rights advocates like those at Seneca Falls who wrote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men and women are created equal."
So, and this would be the last question before we get to the amazing questions in our chat or in our Q&A box here. And so that's kind of like everyone's cue to get some more questions in there before we end here. And so my last question is actually about usable pasts. So I think about the work that we do, who it's produced for, and ultimately how the insights that go from your mind to your pen to your fingers to the book, Liberty is Sweet, how can communities use the history that you're telling in classrooms? I saw on Twitter early, we had some teachers in the room here, in our virtual room. So speaking not only to those in the university setting, but broadly speaking out to the primary and secondary school educators, how can Liberty is Sweet be used as, you know, in our usable past, especially because we are trying to, you know, I would say I can't necessarily speak for everybody, you know, necessarily in the chat here, but we want to be able to use our histories that we tell, that we write, for broader audiences. So I'm very interested to know your answer to that.
Well, Adam, one answer I have to that is something I just learned recently. I mean, I've been using Twitter to get all this evidence into the hands of, especially my target audience for this evidence has been U.S. history teachers, K through 12, but you know, with an emphasis on the 9, 10, 11, 12. But what I just learned in the last few days is I have a graduate student who had a career, Jennifer Marler, who had a career as a teacher herself, first down in Savannah. And she had this great other use of Twitter, which was she took her students to Savannah. These would be high school students that she was able to turn loose in the town of Savannah, turn them loose. And then she went and hid at a historic site in Savannah and then tweeted out hints about where she was. So this was a human scavenger hunt. And so I could see someone using the tweets that I've done about white reactions to Governor Dunmore's proclamation, or to me, the most exciting parts of this are the stories, not so much. It just seems so obvious that of course whites would be furious at this Anglo-Black alliance. To me, the more exciting part of it is to focus on the African-Americans who had initiated this alliance. So for instance, there was an enslaved pilot, that is a river pilot named Joseph Harris in Hampton, Virginia, who escaped from his owner one night in July 1775 and went and presented himself to a British Navy captain who did need a pilot to avoid going aground in all those sandbanks and shoals that you know about around Virginia. And so he was, long before Governor Dunmore issued his Emancipation Proclamation, Joseph Harris obtained his freedom that way. And over the course of the next two months, he saved two of his captains from being captured by the Patriots. And it's people like him who proved their usefulness to the British. So I'm thinking about doing something more focused on those people. You know, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar wasn't just a basketball player. He's been writing great Black history for ordinary people. So I think there are a lot of people who are better writers than me. Here I am trying to plug a book, but I'll never be Kareem, or Nicole Hannah Jones, who are doing a great job, I think, of getting those stories out. The problem is that there is a backlash of people who are trying to cancel Black history, especially K-12, although they're also aiming at it in some states. I'm aware of Ohio in particular, where they're trying to shut down a whole lot of Black history, even at the college level. And it really broke my heart to read a book. I got it on Amazon for like $7. Oops, Amazon, I was in a hurry. Sorry. I should have gotten it from what's this cool bookstore in Mount Airy?
Oh, yeah, Uncle Bobby's Coffee and Books in Germantown. Yes.
But I read the controversy, so I ordered it, got it for $7. It's called Ruby Goes to School, and it's by Ruby Bridges, who's famous from the drawing. I'm forgetting the name of the famous drawer. I'll remember in a second, who made her famous on the cover of the Saturday Evening Post. Maybe somebody else mentioned it in the chat. But anyway, because she integrated the New Orleans schools as a something like 5 or 7 year old. And as an adult, she wrote up that story, pitching it at 5 to 7 year olds. So it's a sophisticated story, but in very clear language. And it's a beautiful story. And one of the things it's about is reconciliation. That is, white parents screamed at her the first day, but there was a white teacher in this all white school who welcomed her and, you know, risked her life by doing so, just as Ruby was risking her life by going to that school. And then the white kids wouldn't talk to her, but then finally one did, and she ended up making friends, not with all of them, but some of them. It's a real story of redemption and reconciliation. And in Williamson County, Tennessee, right now, there are people trying to ban Ruby Goes to School. So I told you I got a copy for myself. I also sent a copy to the library in that county and urged other people to do the same, because one of the most valuable things that people can do right now is fight. And I don't mean violently fight, because we don't have to do it violently, but to enter this fight against the censorship of the 1619 Project in particular. In my home state of Virginia, I'm very sorry to say that a man is running for governor of Virginia, and his platform has come down to elect me governor, and I'm going to get rid of books like Toni Morrison's beloved, Toni Morrison, who of course won the Nobel Prize for literature for her work. And but she's a Black lady writing mostly about African, not entirely about African Americans. And Beloved is a tough book about a woman who escaped slavery, but they came after her and she killed her child to prevent that child being enslaved and the victim of sexual assault later in life. And so it's a tough, tough book, but let's not ban it. And his name is Youngkin, and his whole platform in the final days of that Virginia election, I'm very sorry to say, has come down to, I'm the guy that's gonna allow parents, white parents who feel uncomfortable by that book, to save their children from having to read it. And just generally, he's running the whole thing against 1619 and this mythical critical race theory and so forth. So I think a big thing we all unfortunately need to be doing, yes, educating, but also fighting censorship.
Exactly, and you know, the interesting thing is the firestorm that has already hit the 1619 Project. It hasn't even started really yet, because her book, or the larger book project is not coming out until next month, which I believe the Free Library will have an event. So make sure to go to their page so you can get tickets for that event. I might even be there, who knows? To start the questions off here. So because I didn't ask for consent before, I will not tell, you can probably see it, but you know, to let folks know the name. So we have one question in, question for Dr. Holton. As you explained, you've been sharing a lot of evidence demonstrating how enslaved people's perceived alliance with the British pushed British colonists toward rebellion. Can you explain a bit about the reaction you've seen? What do you think this says about the average American's understanding of their revolution today? And how could the revolution be taught better in schools to create a more comprehensive understanding?
So I'm really glad to hear that question, because that person totally got what I'm saying. They may not agree with it or whatever, but they understand what I'm trying to say. And I really appreciate that. There's been a lot of positive reaction, of course, but there has been negative reaction. I mentioned Gordon Wood has really come out against the whole idea that African-Americans could have had influence. And I won't try to make his argument for him. You can find it in his latest book, and a lot of people have been making it for him on my Twitter page. The biggest argument they make is Dunmore issued his Emancipation Proclamation on November 15th, 1775. And Gordon argues, well, the cake was already baked by then. That is, whites had already turned against the British by November 15, 1775 for other reasons. And in response to that, I did another sub-series of my countdown to 1619. That's my hashtag. A sub-series called Virginia Before Dunproc. That is before Dunmore's proclamation. And in that one, I could have done more, but so far I think I have 24 quotes from white Virginians expressing anger at this British Black alliance long before Dunmore's proclamation. And it was fun for me as a biographer of Abigail Adams to be reminded by John Bell on Twitter that it was Abigail Adams who recorded the first rumor in September of 1774, so more than a year before Dunmore's proclamation. She heard that Blacks in Boston, remember there were enslaved people in all 13 of the colonies that rebelled, Blacks in Boston had sent a petition to Governor Gage, who was also the commander in chief of British forces in America, saying, put us to work, man, we will fight for you in return for our freedom. And she had further heard that this proposal by Black Bostonians had been taken seriously by General Gage. You know, he asked one of his aides to look into it. Now, we don't know if that's actually true, because not every rumor is true, but people don't act on truth. People act on what they perceive to be truth. And clearly Abigail Adams and other whites way early in the process were already perceiving that alliance. So I'm sorry, I got off on a tangent dealing with this complaint about, the cake was already baked by November 15th. Let me try to do a little psychoanalysis of my mostly fellow white Americans who are objecting to this. Here's what I think they're really saying. And a couple of times they've said this explicitly. We can't tarnish our heroes. We need to have a few people like Thomas Jefferson and George Washington to unite around, because they say we are a very diverse nation, different languages, different ethnicities, different religions, and we need glue to hold us all together so we don't end up at each other's throats. And one of my people on my Twitter page responding to that said, look at who the founders are that Professor Wood are pushing. They are wealthy white men. You begin by excluding half of the population that was female, and then you also exclude African-Americans and so forth. How can you expect us to unite when we can't see ourselves in the people that you want us to unite around? And so my response to the people who say we can't be critical of the founding fathers because we need to unify around them, because we need to unify despite our diversity. I say, don't unify despite our diversity, unite around our diversity. And so I think if we tell the whole story of the founding, that's not aimed at putting down Thomas Jefferson. Of course, he was a slaveholder, and of course, he was a racist. He was a white. Now, he knew better. He said he knew better all the time, and not everybody did that. But he was part of his class. I'm less here to be shocked at what he was than I am at saying, let's see everybody at the table and tell the entire story. I think that historical accuracy requires us to do that. If we want to know why the revolution really happened, we haven't talked about the Native American role in it, but it was huge. If we want to know why it happened, we need to know that. And I also think that secondarily to that, as a byproduct of that, it is not a way of dividing us, as some of the people who are criticizing it say. It's a way of uniting us, not in spite of our diversity, but around our diversity.
So great segue to our next question here, Woody. One of our attendees says, thank you for speaking to us today. My sympathy to you at the loss of your father. Once again, of the indigenous people, like you had actually just mentioned, who played an important role during the American Revolution, which individual stands out as the most influential that you have researched about and that's in Liberty and Sweet?
Ooh, very tough call. If I had to name somebody, it would be someone that many folks that you are watching now have probably heard of, Joseph Brant. Tayendanegea is the closest I can get to his Mohawk name, but whites called him Joseph Brant. And actually, they kind of admired him. There's a lot of portraits by white guys that show him in a very favorable light because he was a great general. And just to provide one, so most of the Iroquois, not all, fought on the British side. And there was one battle in particular, the Battle of Oriskany in July of 1777, fought near the town of Rome, New York. It's up on the New York freeway, the upstate New York. Anyway, what's interesting about it is you had a mixed band. I've been talking about an informal alliance between African-Americans and the British. This was a formal alliance between the Iroquois, Haudenosaunee, the Six Nations of the Iroquois, and the British. They formally allied against the rebel colonists. So anyway, there was a mixed band of Iroquois and British who were together going to form an ambush to try to destroy an oncoming Patriot army encroaching on Iroquois territory. And what's significant about it is not that it was hugely successful, although it was. What's significant about it is that the British officers handed control over this joint Native American British force to Joseph Brant and the other Native leaders there, because they knew that these British officers knew that these Native officers would do a better job than they did. And so we've talked a lot about racial conflict, but here's one of many examples I could give you of racial cooperation, because these British guys, well, they wanted to win the battle. And so they were able to put aside their racism against the Iroquois long enough to get good leaders, and it succeeded, at least at the Battle of Oriskany, and lots of other examples like that.
Okay. And so we're moving towards the end here. We do have one comment here. I don't know if the professor knows this, but Philadelphia public schools have required a year of African-American history in high schools since the year 2005. His work can be of great help to our teachers who, unlike most high school teachers, are expected to teach American history through a Black history lens. As a former teacher of the course, I am so eager to read this book. So...
Oh, that is fantastic. It reminds me of, I did this offer on Twitter that no one has taken me up on, but if you are contingent faculty at a university, active duty military, or a K-12 teacher, and if you will buy my book, of course, I've tried to sell books here, but my profit from each book is $4. Buy my book, take a, you got to sign the title page so no one does this twice. take a picture of the title page, send it to me, and I'll Venmo you $4. Because that's the little bit that I can do to get this book into the hands of more K through 12 teachers. I did not know that Black history was required. That is a wonderful idea that a lot of people here in South Carolina would object to, but there are a lot of us here in South Carolina who think we need that just as much as you do. I'll bet you one of the things they talk about in those Philadelphia classes is the Liberty Bell wouldn't be the Liberty Bell if it wasn't for abolitionists. It was just a bell until it had previously been printed with let freedom, let justice, oh my gosh, I can't remember the expression. Someone sent it in as a comment, but it had a quote about justice on the Liberty Bell. So abolitionists adopted it, started calling it the Liberty Bell. And now we all call it the Liberty Bell, similar to what Lemuel Haynes did for the Declaration of Independence. Oh, I got to look it up because I'm so embarrassed I can't remember. But well, I can talk about that time.
Yeah, I was going to say, as you do that, we do have another question in for you, Woody. Do you think that if Jefferson's deleted paragraph on the issue of enslavement had not been crossed out, that what you're talking about might have been more obvious?
Oh, that's a great question. But first, let me fix my last one. It's proclaim liberty throughout the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. It's a Bible passage that had been printed in the Bell back in the 1750s. But it was abolitionists who said, oh, the irony that it was the bell over the state house when they adopted the Declaration of Independence, making it Independence Hall, and used it as sort of a symbol for the anti-slavery movement. Hardly anybody knows that today. But we know the Liberty Bell, and we know it because of them. So what this questioner is asking about is the big editing job that Congress did. Thomas Jefferson wrote 169 words about slavery in the longest of his 26 grievances against the British. It was three times longer, if I remember right, than any of the others. It was the only one where he accused George III of being a bad Christian, the only one where he fell back on all caps, and it was the most passionate. It was the last one. We know for lots of ways that it was the biggest deal, single biggest reason, according to Jefferson, why he wanted out of the British Empire was, number one, and bear with me on the weird first part, the British forced us to have slaves, and they are now inspiring those same slaves to rebel against us. They weren't inspiring them to rebel, by the way. They were just recruiting them into the army, a very different thing. But there's actually a grain of truth in the first part of that, that the British forced us to have slaves. That sounds ridiculous, I know, but Jefferson himself had enough slaves by then. He pointed out that the men that he claimed to own, that he had enslaved, they were producers of wealth. The women that he had enslaved were also producers of wealth, but they were reproducers of wealth as well. And so he was growing tobacco, but he was growing human beings as well at Monticello. And so he had enough slaves. He didn't want more. He was especially scared of Africans because they seemed likelier to rebel. They probably weren't. Nat Turner wasn't African. Denmark Vesey wasn't African, but he thought they were more scary. So let's have not so many more slaves coming in. Let's not have Africans come in at all. And he had other reasons, which I won't take the time to go into, but people can look it up, for actually objecting to continuing. He didn't want to abolish slavery. He wanted to abolish the external slave trade, that is the slave trade from Africa. He also didn't want to abolish the internal slave trade where he could get mad at a slave and sell them to South Carolina, and that slave would never see his kids again, which Jefferson did a couple of times. But anyway, so in the Declaration of Independence, he first denounces the British for forcing us to have slaves, and then blames them for, correctly in this part, for having an alliance with enslaved people. And so the question was about how did all that get down to seven words, and what are the implications of that? Jefferson himself, and we'll have to leave it at this for time, said there was a coalition of Lower South Congress people who wanted to keep buying slaves from Africa and Northerners who were involved in the slave trade, who wanted to keep the slave trade going because they didn't have a ton of slaves, but they had ships that were slave ships, especially in Rhode Island. The implications of that, I think, is a wonderful what if question. What if they'd left all of that in the Declaration of Independence? I'm going to go big on this and say it might have had a huge impact in being more honest about the Black role, because it would have just been so obvious. If you read, you can just Google Jefferson rough draft Declaration of Independence to see what he said. Had it been there, people would have known that enslaved people were a part of that story from the beginning. And probably if it was kind of, they gave up the game in the original declaration. It would have been harder for Lemuel Haynes to turn it into a freedom document. So maybe that never would have happened. But then B, you know, they never used the word slave in the final draft of the Declaration of Independence. They also never used the word slave in the Constitution. And they might not have been so squeamish about it in the Constitution. That is, if we'd been open about it in the Declaration of Independence, as Jefferson wanted to be, they might have been open about it in the Constitution as well. And so the status of America, the founding of America as a slaveholder's republic, would have been a lot more clear right from the start. And yeah, I think we would have known our history a lot better. And maybe that would have been to our advantage.
And one of the last questions that we'll get to today, is we were told we can do a little extra time here. I believe it was you who I heard talk about this, because you had spoken before about, you know, having a fellowship out at the Huntington, and they have, you know, their lectures every now and again. I believe they record them. And I say that because I heard you speak about this project from a couple years ago. It's either there or the Newberry, maybe. But suffice it to say, you also wanted to talk about the actual violence of the war, right? Because obviously we talk a lot about the Civil War being so deadly, we'll say, as opposed to just simply just violent. But can you also talk a bit more about the actual battlefield aspect of the war? And also, let's also talk about how also in war, there are, you know, a myriad of different roles you can play. So if you can also talk about the role of enslaved and free Black women as well in the story of just wartime warfare as well, because there's some stories I've seen painted across some of your works that I've read throughout your illustrious career.
Okay, a lot there. Let me first say, I see there's still some questions. Please come to Twitter, those of you whose questions didn't get answered, and throw them to me there. I'm a little bit of an addict of Twitter, and I will, it may take me a while, but I'd love to answer your take on your questions, and you may disagree with my response, and we'll have a good exchange. Let's take the end of that question first about enslaved women. I mentioned Mary Beth Norton, the great women's historian at Cornell. She took the list of 3,000 African-Americans who left with the British, left from New York City at the end of the war. And of all the horrible things, and I could say a lot of horrible things about the British Empire, of all the things you can say about them, they did do one decent thing, and that is they kept their promise to the enslaved people who they had said, if you fight for your king, we'll free you. They did. And now they didn't treat them very well. They took them to Nova Scotia, where they were oppressed by their fellow British loyalists, and many ended up in Sierra Leone, they were oppressed by taxes. And some of them, there was one guy named Harry Washington who had been owned by George Washington. And guess what? Harry Washington led in Sierra Leone, a tax revolt against the British. But the British did keep their promise. Oh, and I was saying Mary Beth Norton, she found that the majority of the people who fled with the British at the end of the war, those 3,000, were women and kids. Now, there were more men than anything else, but if you add women plus children. And so there were just a ton of women in the British camps right from the start. And I'd written about this in a couple of previous books, but the fun discovery for me, and I want somebody to paint this as a painting and send me a copy. And that is a German fighting as a mercenary on the British side, talking about the sight of all of these African-American women riding horses with the British Army. And that's a bottom rail on top story or image, to see all these African-American women serving in the British Army. You know, women played such a crucial role. Just by washing shirts, you're saving lives, as a student of mine has discovered, because shirts have lice, and lice spread typhus, which was the number one killer of soldiers after smallpox, after and George Washington inoculated most of the army against smallpox. But just conjure up that image of those African-American women riding on their horses. And I don't know how they knew how to ride. They certainly, very few of them had been allowed to learn, but they figured it out because that way lay freedom. About the violence, historians are rediscovering that. They used to write a lot about the violence. It's certainly the case here in South Carolina, where the first person killed in the revolution was a free Black a pilot, somewhat similar to Joseph Harris that I talked about in Virginia. This man's name was Thomas Jeremiah. He's the subject of two wonderful biographies. And showing the complexity of things, he was economically successful, owned a couple of boats. He owned a couple of slaves as well. Now, we don't know exactly who they were, so they may have been relatives of his who he was keeping as slaves as a way of protecting them, because often if free Blacks were in really vulnerable, we don't know who they were, but probably they were enslaved workers. But he was suspected of participating in a conspiracy. The British were suspected by whites, as we talked about earlier, of possibly being part of that conspiracy. And they hanged and burned him in August of 1776 in Virginia. So that's the first violence to talk about, literally the first in that case, because he was the first fatality of the revolution in the state where I live today. We could also talk about violence involving Native Americans, although we historians, I think most of us say this, that the Native Americans really won the war in the West. The only way they got dispossessed was that the British abandoned them, but on the ground, they won the war. But then a lot of people have also been focusing on the violence even among whites, which is certainly the case. And there's some great scholarship coming out on that now too.
Yeah, and it just makes me think also just about, you know, the kind of, honestly, the way that you can also see the violence of commodification, where you had in Virginia, especially, right, someone like James Armistead Lafayette, who was a spy, you know, for the Patriots in Virginia. And it's not until, I think it's what, 1780, it's either 87 or 89, that he becomes free. And so what I always think about and what I write about is the amount of time between 1781 and 1787 or 89, whichever year it was, it's immense. And the kind of, and really the kind of violence that he would have experienced, right, to him, and also visually, right, the experience of the enslaved experience in and of itself, and that you put yourself out there where you could have been killed, right, or murdered brutally, right? Because effectively he was doing what Jeremiah was suspected of doing, right? Which, you know, on a different scale of like sides per se, but we are pretty certain that if he would have gotten caught, he probably would have been murdered, if anything. And then also, you know, a buddy of mine that you know, Dr. Gallagher at APS, who's writing about, you know, the public works side, right? Looking at how resistance helped fuel the munitions development in Virginia and other places of the Revolutionary South. And so that's in and of itself very violent too. So, you know, so gotta plug his work. And so we are getting to about the end here. And so as our final thing here, takeaways, right? Takeaways from your book. first of all, once again, congratulations. This is an amazing book that I'm excited that people are going to get to see and read and do some bicep curls with as well. You put some words in there, my friend. So takeaways from Liberty is Sweet. I'm actually very interested in a short before we get out of here. Throughout this process of developing this book, I'm interested, what have you learned about yourself even as a writer a historian? And also now, right, you've always been doing this, but especially now in this age, someone who's engaging in these public debates, what have you learned?
Oh, I think that's an interesting question, of course. I think I've learned more about the debates. I've definitely learned that I have an addictive personality that I've been fortunate it hasn't come out before through alcohol or anything like that. But boy, Twitter's brought it out. Because here's what happens, Adam, is these people come in, at least as I'm perceiving it, completely overconfident. That is, the people who are saying, African-Americans had nothing to do with it, with the American Revolution. They were affected by it, but they didn't affect it. And they come in so overconfident and so underprepared. It's like being at the state fair and seeing the little ducky go by, and he's going by so slow. You could say, I can win a stuffed animal real, real easily. And so they're almost like sitting ducks if people are making really tough argument, I go, oh, I'm too tired. I'm going to go to bed. I'll deal with that in the morning. But they make it so easy for you. And I don't know, there's things I've had about myself that I don't like. I never use sarcasm with my students. One of my proudest moments as a teacher, Adam, wasn't in the classroom, but I was at the Met in New York looking at the famous Emmanuel Lutz Washington crossing the Delaware, and started talking to the guard. And he said, I got a question for you. You're a teacher? I go, yeah. I got a question for you. Washington came after Columbus. Is that right? And I'm so proud of myself because I said, that is correct. Rather than, you dummy, of course he did. Everybody came, all the whites came after Columbus. But you get tempted to do that sometime. And this guy was a real striver. And he just wanted to know. And that's how most of my students, some don't want to know anything, but the vast majority are here at the University of South Carolina. I just sat in on one of my teaching assistants class, and it's just like my class. The vast majority of those students had something to say, questions or thoughts. It was really exciting. So my point is, I'm never sarcastic in class, but these people who come in with these such ignorance and yet such a sense of superiority, it brings out an ugly side of me, which is my sarcastic side. So what I've started doing with people who I know aren't really asking questions, but trying to trip me up or just making those ridiculous claims, I've just started giving the hashtag for these evidence trails that I've left of all these quotations. And because I'm not just sending out tweets, each one has a quote from somebody at the time and then a picture of the document. So I'm just trying to, so that I don't fall for my own tendency towards sarcasm with those ignorant and yet overconfident people, I just send them the hashtag and hope they go there.
Well, yeah, no. And let me tell you, as someone who has definitely been on Twitter a lot over these last couple of years, and you know, your presence on the platform has been great. And also just, you know, seeing all the, you know, build up towards your book. And, you know, like I said, this has been a fun culmination of nearly 5 years. Now that, you know, I'm you know, writing, you know, in the stage of dissertation writing, you know, having your amazing book. And also before we end up too, we also have to say that, you know, it's been 60 years since the publication of Benjamin Quarles's Negro in the American Revolution, and also 30 years since the now recently deceased Sylvia Frey's Water from the Rock, Black Resistance in a Revolutionary Age, was also published in 1991. Right. So you know, gotta definitely give our condolences to the Frey family and everyone down in Tulane. And so now 30 years from her book, we can now add Liberty is Sweet to this 61, 91, 2021. And who knows, maybe I'll write something for 2041 as well. So hopefully I can add to the amazing just groundbreaking.
Yeah, don't wait till 31 though. We need you sooner than that.
Oh no. I gotta make sure that I'm I gotta get this tenure thing once I get this dissertation thing done too. So but one step at a time, as my mother would say. Woody, once again, thank you for the opportunity to be in conversation with you this evening. And thank you to everyone who came through today. Please go grab the book, Liberty is Sweet, the hidden history of the American Revolution, and make sure you buy it through our friends here at the Free Library of Philadelphia by way of Uncle Bobby's Coffee and Books. And shout out to Dr. Mark Lamont Hill, the owner of that amazing establishment in the Germantown section of Philadelphia. So thank you so much.
Cool. I can't wait to go visit it next time I'm up there. All righty. Thanks, everybody. And those of you who didn't get your questions, ask me on Twitter. Thank you so much. Wonderful, wonderful. I enjoyed it. I don't know if anybody else did, but I really appreciate it, Adam. Thank you.
Yes. No, this is fun.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.